Okay, good morning, nice to see you. In this series of talks and the larger course, which most of you are doing on an introduction to art history, there have been many exotic journeys to ancient Assyria, to Egypt, to different parts of southern Asia, parts of the world, partly, of course, to enjoy and start to appreciate the content of the visual culture of these different parts of the world, but also to shake up our preconceptions and our definitions and our methods of dealing with our discipline of art history. And each of these, as we've been seeing, problematizes some of the assumptions built into an art history that was born in Western Europe and continues to questioning itself, debating its role, but continues to use terms and to offer it with assumptions that were born in a particular environment. And this is, of course, part of the intention of this course, a very important part of the intention of this whole course, is to help ourselves to think a little bit about where we want to take that discipline, in addition to what we might do with the particular contents of these different visual cultures. And problematizing the discipline is something we can also do by looking at Western art. Today we're just going to look for a little while at architecture in an European context, in fact specifically in the context of the later Middle Ages. And in doing so, to think a little bit about these cathedrals that we'll be looking at, but also to think about how we deal with the subject of architecture, actually, and how we conceptualize a field of visual production, which in modern times has come to be separated from other things that people do, other cultural activities, including other visual activities. And in fact, the way we understand the history of architecture has been really quite problematized by this, by a confusion as to how buildings are and have been made. There's a lot of mythology still surrounding the building, in particular, of great churches in medieval Europe. In the 19th century, when people started first to be interested again in the medieval past of Europe, there was a very widespread myth, notion, legend that the great buildings of the period had been built by ordinary lay people, driven by piety, or by monks. Since then, in the 20th century, historical research has turned up the names of hundreds of professionals, masons, carpenters, glaziers, who worked on building sites. And we've got a rather different image now of the professionalization of the field of building. But what's still confusing, I think, to many observers of these buildings now, is the modern notion of the architect. Because the profession of the grand designer, I mean, we'll think of examples of modern architects who are shaping our world, who are changing the skyline of London, who are putting up prestige museums. This grandiose and prestigious role is a modern one. Actually, when you think architects were professionalized, they professionalized as recently as the late 19th century, and not before. And the separation, too, of the high arts of architecture together with sculpture and painting are also, as you know, that separation is also a renaissance of later phenomenon. But in particular, architecture has been further distinguished by this professionalization in modern times. You know, if Renzo Piano turns up to look at the Shard while it's going up, it's once in a blue moon, and he'll put on a hard hat and he'll go around in his nice Armani suit and not get too close to the workmen who are connecting the wires or changing, fitting the plumbing and so forth. There's a disconnect now between the designer and the building site, which is very, very different from that which operated in the medieval past and indeed in architectural construction in other cultures. Some of the masons, and we'll see this actually a little bit later who worked on building sites in the Middle Ages did acquire individual reputations of quite high fame and prestige, but their training and experience was on the building site as stone cutters and construction engineers, as we would say. This was common to all of their profession. And the master mason on a site, who would act as the overall designer, and he was usually called the master of the works, the magister operarum, the master of the works, would never be wholly detached from the journeyman, the team. So this separation of the design from the knowledge of how to build is a post-medieval development, as I said. There's a larger issue to think about here when we think about creation, in not only in architecture but in other fields. Indeed, this separation in the field of architecture is a peculiarly Western phenomenon, which has been imposed, as I say, during the last five centuries and particularly during the last 150 years. Outside this particular Western and modern tradition, the integration of the design and the manufacture, which we find on the building sites of the medieval cathedrals, we'll look at some examples now, has been equally characteristic of most cultural production into history. So it's something very odd, actually, about architecture in particular, the way it's been conceptualized, and actually the way it's been studied academically. Architectural historians tend to be a breed apart. They work in, there are departments of architectural history, or more particularly, most architectural historians in academia work in architecture departments. That's where there are positions for architectural historians, and that's where they tend to find themselves lecturing to more or less interested would-be Renzo Pianos of the future. But Matthew Walker, who was an architectural historian who was here for a few years, just has moved on to a post in America just now, in this department, would, were he here, he would completely agree with this. This perception of the work, this imaginary of how buildings supposedly were created by a special breed of person, of creative, has created also within academic art history a notion that architecture is something separate from other fields of visual production. Now, another preconception about great buildings of the Middle Ages is that they were conceived as grand unified designs, as it were, Renzo Piano's shard. And I think there's something interesting to learn from this, the realization of a completely integrated building design was extremely rare. Actually, it's extremely rare today. There aren't many Renzo Pianos, there aren't many shards, there aren't many Bilbao museums for Frank Gehry to conceive as a totality. In practice, even today, and certainly in these medieval examples we'll be looking at, construction was usually a matter of partial intervention within pre-existing structures, and only rarely was a building constructed in a single campaign from its foundations. And as we'll see, this gives rise to local debates about what's appropriate, should things be changed, should they be kept the same, and discussions which draw in others beyond, well beyond, in some cases, the practitioners who are actually going to put the new building up. The best chance you might have if you wanted something exciting and new was a fire, and indeed the Middle Ages gave many fires. In the late 12th century, in Canterbury, we can observe this happening. The murder of Thomas Becket in front of his own high altar of the Cathedral of Canterbury in 1170 caused a storm across Christendom, which you will all know something about. And the monks of the cathedral, prior of Canterbury, were quick to, of course, mourn his death and then promote the cult of the martyred saint, the victim of a royal intervention, which many felt exaggerated. frustrated, to say the least, and which did indeed catalyse the beginnings of what became an enormous, one of the great pilgrimage cults of late medieval Europe. 4 years after the death of Becket, so still in the early 1170s, in 1174, a fire destroyed a very large part of the building, especially at the east end. And we have from one of the monks, who wrote a chronicle during this period, a vivid account of the process of consultation with various French and English builders which followed. The monk was called Gervase, the monk of Canterbury. And I've put his text and one or two other quotations, if you want them, on the back of the, on one side of your handout, just in case it's useful for the future. What he seems to be doing in, why does he write all this down? It seems to me actually Gervase is covering up a debate and anxiety, perhaps differences of opinion as to what should happen. He says of William of Sens, who was brought from Sens in northern France, to advise on what could be done at the east end of the burnt cathedral. And Gervais says, he spent many days with the monks in a careful study of the burnt walls, above and below, inside and out, but for the time being avoided saying what would have to be done in order not to shock them too much in their enfeebled state of mind. But he kept on getting ready for what was needed for the work, either personally or through agents. And he goes on to say, arrangements were made for bringing stones from overseas, and we know, because we can see the building now, that the stone was brought from Caen in Normandy. And William of Sens, he goes on, designed ingenious machinery for loading and unloading the ships and for the transport of mortar and stones. He handed templates for shaping the stones to the carvers whom he had taken on. And over 4 years, William of Sens, this Frenchman, is described as having made considerable progress, in the course of which he essentially designed this choir, this east end of Canterbury Cathedral that you see today. Sens, in, let's say, northeast France, northern France, from which William had come, and where clearly he'd been working, had just recently completed its own new building project for a new east end, and in what was still a very modern and bold manner, had created a brilliantly high and illuminated east end to frame the high altar of the cathedral, with these soaring pointed vaults, and with the weight now being carried by the new in the 12th century design down through narrow piers to the ground, the weight of the building being concentrated in these piers, the spaces in between the piers could be opened up as never before in medieval times, or indeed in any time, to glass. So this is what had just happened at Sens. William of Sens is clearly an interesting person to somebody who's looking to rebuild and to create a new shrine that will be a pilgrimage shrine for the whole of Europe, for the whole of Christendom, and some of the monks in Canterbury get him over, and this is what results. And you can see that it's in three stories, one tall story at the, so to speak, ground floor level, at the level of the nave, and the ambulatory around the east end, same in Canterbury, a less tall gallery level with a passage, same here, and then a tall-ish, pretty tall clerestory level with more light let in from above, and in the case of the Canterbury east end, illuminating the high altar with what were now to be the gathered, most of the gathered relics of the martyred Archbishop. In addition, at the very, very far east end of Canterbury Cathedral, another a distinctive local phenomenon, Becket, in the course of the attack by the four knights sent by Henry II, the top of Becket's head was cut right off, and the corona, the top of his head, was venerated as a separate relic in what was called the corona, or the crown of the cathedral. cathedral at the east end. So there's an additional little chapel there to house that. What even this short passage from the Contemporary Chronicle hints at for us and significantly shows us, I think, is the complexity that arises in the context of the patronage of a new building, where there will certainly have been debate among the monks as to what should happen, because this is an ancient and a sacred building. It's got older relics of Anglo-Saxon saints venerated for hundreds of years, and there would have been a constituency urging the reparation of the building in exactly its old form. And nothing in, as we would say, architectural terms, nothing of this kind of grandeur, height and light had been seen in these islands before. So this is a radical novelty, and some will have been resistant, and one, I think one detects something of that resistance in order not to shock them too severely and so on in Jervis's account. The patrons then, with their perhaps varying views, play a key role. But William of Sens, the master of the works, is the guy who sources the materials, who gives the moulds for the arcades and so on to the carvers, who oversees the operation, and he makes it a tangible reality. In the fifth year, towards the end of the 1170s, William of Sens had an accident. He fell from the scaffolding, and after a while he had to retire. He went back to France, poor chap. And he seems to have left no complete plan to his successor. This is something which, if we look closely at the work in the East End, we can see there are some disjunctures, and it's not a completely seamless operation. The man who took over, also called William, but he was William the Englishman, completed the design. As I say, this same design, more or less to the original pattern, by 1181. So the project was not, as it were, the inspired moment of a complete vision on the part of one patron. It was a profitable piece of, profitable because it was a huge success as a pilgrimage centre, of course, for hundreds of years. The whole design of the building being conceived as a kind of giant reliquary. Up until this point, relics of the saints were kept underground. You came into the older churches and you went as a pilgrim down into the ground to see the shrine. And here, for the first time, the relics have been brought up. This was the plan from the start. And not only are they up, the high altar is raised with relation to the, you can see some of the steps going up here, from the level of the nave. So those coming in, this is still the experience, if you go to Canterbury, you come in at the west end, you look down the nave, and then raised up at the end, framed and illuminated by these high windows, like in a giant reliquary, as I say, the high altar, from which, of course, in the Reformation, Henry VIII had all the relics carted away. 26 cartloads in 1539 dragged all the riches of Becket's shrine and all the offerings that people had made away. So, anyway, the one moral of this is the unpredictability of art and architectural history. When the hand of God conveniently failed to clear the grounds by a fire, and of course one possibility is that there was a constituency among the monks who lit the flame, it's not at all impossible. But anyway, when the hand of God or anybody else failed to kindle the flames to clear the way for a new building, powerful patrons were at times driven to drastic measures, and I've given his name on your handout. At the beginning of the 13th century, so just a few years later, in a context where a number of people are building new churches, the Bishop of Auxerre, Guillaume de Senilet, in a more high-handed fashion, he's not a community of monks, he's a bishop, he's quite an ambitious and powerful bishop, and according to the local chronicle in this case at Auxerre, he simply had the old one knocked down in order that he could have something really splendid put up. the bishop saw, his cathedral at Auxerre was a very old building and very small, suffering from decay and age, while others in every direction were raising their heads in a wonderfully beautiful style, places like Sens. So he determined on a new building, and that it should be designed by those skilled in the art of masonry, lest it should be in any way unequal to the other. He had it, the old one, pulled down to the ground, so that, putting off the decrepitude of antiquity, it might grow young in a more elegant style of novelty. But again, nowadays we're so used to the language of novelty, the new being the good, that we have to make an effort to think of, to appreciate other cultures in which novelty was not always seen as an undiluted good. And actually, the very word novelty, novitas, in a medieval context, in a 12th or 13th century context, was always a controversial word. It's not often used with the positive connotations, and maybe even this chronicle has a note of irony. You know, the chronicler himself is saying, "This is our bishop. You know, he wanted to be new. He wanted the elegance of novitas, of novelty." But we certainly have contemporary texts in which novelty is criticised as being a departure from good tradition. And on the whole, this kind of clean sweep, knock it all down and I'll build a new one, was not an option. At Saint-Denis, just outside Paris, an hour ride from the centre of Paris, at the beginning of the 12th century, the abbot, Suger, again the spellings are on the sheet, wanted to see his church rebuilt on a grandiose scale, and we have Suger's own writings, very interesting. Why does he write at great length, actually, about his project to rebuild the abbey church? Pretty certainly because within his monastic community there were those who thought this was a terrible thing, and that he was perhaps self-aggrandizing, but in any case he was reckless in dismantling parts of what was a very ancient church that had been founded by Charlemagne, possibly according to one legend even founded by Christ himself. And here was Abbot Suger proposing that it be partly pulled down. Suger's own personal involvement is inscribed in the building. There are seven places to this day where you can see Suger's image and read his name here in one of the stained glass windows that survive from his early 12th century work. You see the kneeling figure of the abbot in his monastic robes and Sugerius Ab, Abbot Suger, the label just in case you not sure which he is, and he was also on the west door as you came in and other places. These images and the liveliness of his own text, actually wrote two books about the whole project, the liveliness of his accounts have led modern scholars to think of Suger as in effect the designer of Saint-Denis. And this is quite significant given the what we now understand as the importance, the architectural importance of the building that went up in the 1130s and 1140s at Saint-Denis. This building is, by all accounts, a crucially important building in the whole history of architecture, and particularly in the history of Western architecture, and is regarded as, it's the first of those buildings which, by using pointed rather than round arches, and even more significantly by carrying the weight of the stone building and its roof, not down through great thick walls, but through actually quite slender piers, has broken through to a new understanding of how you can put up a building and how you can create enormous parts of the walls of that building, which are not structural, they're simply empty. So they can be as empty or as light as you like. They can be filled with glass. So this combination of height with the arcades and light with the opening of the outer walls happens here first. There are a couple of preceding experiments. It doesn't just come completely out of nowhere. But the interest in Saint-Denis, large parts of it were rebuilt in the 13th century, so only parts, but this is part of, this is a section, remained from Abbot Suger's own day. enormous importance attached to this, and therefore to sujet. But what is the role of the patron? How much importance are we going to give to the person who chooses to associate his name in writing, in images, with the building? He's abbot, certainly. But although his interest in the project as a patron is very clear, there's no evidence that he had any technical ability to oversee, and still less to actually invent the structure, which, as I say, is no ordinary structure here, with its buttresses to support, to hold up this newly colonnaded structure, and with its new stained glass windows. One of the most famous of all art historians wrote one of the most famous of all art historical studies on this building and on sujet, Panofsky. When Panofsky, first half of the 20th century, seized upon this as a kind of model case study for the art historian, because he felt, here we have the formula. We have an intelligent, educated patron whom we can actually hypothesize read certain texts, and I'll come to this in a minute, and translated those texts into a blueprint, a program for the artisans who would realize his vision. And the books that Panofsky identified were the very specific book, actually. It was a book about angels. Not a trivial book at all, a very extensive and serious book about angels, very widely known in the Middle Ages, attributed to somebody called Dennis or Dionysius. And Dionysius' book on angels and the angelic hierarchy talked in a very Platonic way, Christian writing, but very Platonic, about how divine power is mediated to earth through successive levels of, or prisms, or as we might say, lenses, filtering that divine power, that divine light, so that it manifests itself in the diversity of the world. And conversely then, the world is a pattern which, if you read it in the reverse direction, is through these lenses, or angels, or angelic spheres, leading back to its divine origin. So this was a way of understanding the diversity and the beauty of the world. And sujet, according to Panofsky, having read this book, not an obscure book, had imbibed it and wanted to make in his building, through his treatment of light as it passes through these coloured windows, in his inclusion of many beautifully decorated ornaments, I haven't included them, for the high altar, which he talks about in just these terms. Beautiful gems, he says, attract the eye and then lead the mind upwards to the source of all light, which is God. So quite an exciting hypothesis, and one which was offered as a model for understanding. Actually, it's not too grand to say the history of art. An intelligent, educated patron can direct the relevant artisans to realise their design. That's why it's a significant model. But there's no getting away from the fact, if you look closely at the masonry of a building like this, or even from where you're sitting, it's not easy to cut these stones and place them and make this work. I mentioned there are a couple of precedents from the years before, from just a very few years before, a decade before this, a very nearby church, Saint-Martin-des-Champs, Saint Martin, also north of Paris, shows masons experimenting with just this formula on a small part of the east end of the church, and you can see that at the time, you can actually see that they got the weights wrong, the ceiling started to crumble, and it's still and it's locked in a distorted breakage, which is clear, you can see, is original. These were masons who were experimenting with new ideas. The patron certainly wouldn't have been able to understand what they were doing in terms of the practicalities. So it was following convention that the patron presented himself as the maker of this Suchet's portrait being that son. But the new church was not the creation of some clever intellectual theory imposed by the patron, but of professional builders. And also, it was more experimental itself and inconsistent in itself than textbooks tend to say. And this is another point about architectural history. Architectural history, when you read it, when you encounter buildings being described in art history books, that you're presented with a building. So here's Saint-Denis. It is the first Gothic church, and these are the features it has. And I summarily just did the same thing. But actually, it's shot through with inconsistencies, just as I said Canterbury was, you know, where William Massance was, he had to cry off for ill health, and another took over. We can see the joins, we can see the slight changes of plan. And this, again, might have a lesson for us, not just in terms of medieval buildings, but of art and its production more generally. Often, as with the Bishop of Auxerre, whom we just encountered, a patron was spurred on by the sense that other people were putting up excellent buildings and they wanted for prestige to compete. Just to take an example from the end of the medieval period, the beginning of the 16th century, Bishop Oliver of Bath and Wells, both his episcopal bases, joined together. He said, anyway, he had a dream. This is, of course, another way of justifying it. As a result of my dream, I would like the priory church of the very ancient priory church of Bath to be razed to the ground, and we're going to put up something really wonderful that I've seen in my dream in its place. And that was the justification that was given. He hired the masons, whose names we know, and we know something about them, who were called Virtue, Robert and William Virtue. The older brother of the two, Robert, had previously worked with his father on the king's works, on the royal, phenomenal royal chapel, the most prestigious building in the country in the late Middle Ages, which was the east end of Westminster Abbey, the Henry VII, what became the Henry VII chapel. And actually, I'll just show you the next slide. So on the right-hand side of the screen, you see what Adam Virtue and Robert Virtue had produced for the new Royal East End of Westminster Abbey in the last years of the 15th century. This too, the like of this had never been seen, not really quite like this. There are, once again, experiments with this kind of patterned, what's come to be called fan vaulting. So that, again, this doesn't come from nowhere, but the masons clearly pushed the boat out of what they were going to try to do for the royal patrons in this instance, and clearly those at court in particular, and the court includes not only secular but the ecclesiastical peers of the realm, the bishops, Bishop Oliver of Bath and Wells would have been there, they're all talking about this. And so the Bishop of Bath and Wells in this instance in 1502 gets hold of Robert Virtue and says, "Come down to my place. I've just had a vision. I think we'll have a new building." And on a smaller scale, and in fact in a context where different models are used for the rebuilding, the old, low, dark, thick-walled and narrow-windowed Romanesque priory church of Bath was razed to the ground, and it was replaced by the high clerestoried. No gallery in between, so the clerestory is enormous with these enormous windows. These lateral features of the building you're looking at, which is Bath Abbey to this day, are modelled on the parish churches of Somerset in this period. But the ceiling, where he got in, which the Virtues, the brothers Virtue, were also involved, is a simplified version of what had been just put up at Westminster Abbey. And we can see the mentality behind the patron's choice here in this letter, which I've quoted for you, in which he says to one of the secular ministers of the king, "Robert and William Virtue have been here with me that can report on the state and forwardness of this our church of Bath and of the vault devised for the chancel of the said church, whereunto, as they say now, there shall be none so goodly, neither in England nor in France. So in cases like this of Abbot Suger and Bishop Oliver, we can see the ambition and the taste of the patron had a clear bearing on the direction of the building operation, but the practical business of making the structure lay firmly with the craftspeople who learned how to do these things in the mason's yard, constantly experimenting, perhaps trying out some new ideas, but that's where the practical learning is concentrated. I've mentioned this tendency of art history to deal with complete objects and complete buildings, and that this is misleading. There's always been a tendency for building projects to remain incomplete. As I say, academic art histories tended to privilege the appreciation of whole buildings over fragments, but the reality is that only a minority of structures can be said to be entire with respect to a single design. Even apart, and I'm not talking about this today, but I mentioned at the beginning the separation of architectural history from other kinds of history. Well, one massive result of that is that studies of great churches, for example, tend to be carried out by architectural historians who look at the architecture. The functioning of those buildings depended upon furnishings, upon hangings, upon altars and altarpieces, upon liturgical equipment, all of which were made by a whole host of and diversity of different craftspeople, and were in their practical use as much as the architecture catalysts of response, understanding, creation of meaning in the building. But if we stick only with the architecture, we need to hoist in the non-completion of many, if not most, buildings. But not only that, it's actually interesting, it can be illuminating to look at the reasons why buildings aren't finished according to a single Renzo Piano kind of design. The many structural problems encountered on medieval sites draw attention to the way in which master masons tended to work empirically, pragmatically, like in Saint-Martin-des-Champs, as I mentioned just now, north of Paris, just after 1100, feeling their way towards solutions which were not always clear at the start. We can see this very dramatically in this instance, the amazing space of Beauvais choir. So this is another one of the great 13th century northern French cathedral buildings, where the masons just went up and up and up. And it's a very French thing, this competitive. You noticed it with the Bishop of Auxerre. All people are going up, I want to go up too. This pretty much touched the sky at 46.8 metres from the floor there. If you look at the furniture in the foreground, you think of these chairs, it gives you a bit of an idea of the distance to the ceiling. But here again, there's an element of the hazardous about it, deliberately hazardous, the consciously hazardous and experimental. And actually, they got as far as the crossing, working from the east end, as often was the case, working from the east end, they got as far as the crossing, and they got a couple of bays into the nave, and then the cracks started opening up. And they stopped. So from the outside, what you see today, this is an old photograph, but this is what you see today. You see this, so there it is, there's the chancel and the crossing and the beginning of the nave. And at that point, they realized that this was far, far, far too dangerous. Great. Chunks of masonry started falling off, and they called a halt. And you can see the height of the nave. After all, it was a little bit lower than that. They pulled back. I mean, the reasons, as I say, the reasons for interruption are interesting. The reasons why if we understand this, then we need to ask slightly different questions about the motives for embarking on this kind of project, because there is something undoubtedly heroic and hazardous about embarking on a project, the details of which are not understood. Clearly they weren't understood from the beginning. Many designs evolved in the course of execution. again underlining the role of the unpredictable. Okay, this is one of my big themes this morning, I hope it's coming across, and the importance of an element of pragmatism on the part of the builders. Sometimes the appearance of alarming cracks generated extraordinary and brilliant solutions. So the 13th century nave and crossing at Wells Cathedral in Somerset, and in particular the enormous height and weight of the tower in the 14th century, in the early 14th century, began to create cracks in the lower parts around the crossing, the nave, and in the crossing. So there was fear that the whole thing would just splay out and the tower would collapse. And these reverse arches, scissor arches, were invented. They're a pragmatic invention in around 1330 of a brilliant architect turning near disaster to create a new invention, which has worked so far. On the other hand, at Ely Cathedral in the 1330s, the central tower collapsed. It simply fell, it collapsed on itself. And so that was obviously a catastrophe, which had to be resolved in some way. Here we have again a chronicle, the 14th century monastic chronicle of Ely, which attributes what we're looking at is the replacement, the amazing octagon of Ely Cathedral, the 14th century solution to that particular local disaster. And the chronicler attributes it to the sacrist, the monk who was responsible for the ornaments and maintenance of the church of the building, who was called Alan of Walsingham. And once again, readers of this have tended to say, oh, Alan Walsingham, a brilliant patron, somebody who has an idea. Maybe he's the clever person who thought, let's go for an eight-sided tower, let's include other novel features. But again, much more likely is it that the sacrist was seen at the time as taking responsibility for the repair, but that the required practical skill lay in other hands, and it's a work of genius. This, here's the exterior anyway to admire, and then from the inside, standing underneath this crossing tower and looking up, this is what you see, and it's as though the designer is saying, well, we did have a massive square tower and it was very venerable and wonderful, but actually now we've got a heavenly vault to look at and look up at, with these soaring clusters of ribs surrounding an octagon, which itself, because it rises higher, is illuminated all around and creates this sense of a heavenly sphere above. So there's a theatre, a drama, a theological message too about that, which is brilliant, original, and also breathtaking. Because after all, didn't the other one just fall down? And doesn't this look like an even more complex and risky building? It looks like an achievement in stone that would be completely impossible. And indeed, in stone, it would have been completely impossible. It looks as if it's built in stone, but it's entirely made of wood. So again, ingenuity, and brilliance and creativity can come out of that mason's yard with the stimulus of certain challenges in particular patrons, and we need to think about the interaction of all these elements and not just formulaically about one rich or ambitious or well-read patron coming up with an idea and having the artisan simply execute it. There's another, I think this is the final example of this kind of experimentation that I wanted to show you, at Siena Cathedral. Siena's built on a series of hills, and on the top of one of which, legend had it, there'd been a temple of Diana, and this was the site of the early Christian church of Siena, the mother church, and where in the late 13th century, which is the period of greatest expansion of the commune of Siena, the republican government of the city, on the basis of banking in particular and trade, was newly rich, it was powerful, and it was reconstructing its image, if you like, or the image of the city, through great public works, and this was a great civic project, not a narrowly or specifically ecclesiastical project. It was one that was funded by and overseen by the Signoria, the civil rulers of the Sienese Republic, and they replaced again an old, dark, and low Romanesque church of the 12th century at the end of the 13th and into the early 14th centuries with what the structure you see here. What happened just demonstrates, I suppose, what I've been saying more than once, which is that patrons can have the most visionary dreams and the most ambitious ideas and the most competitive propagandistic motives, but it's masons who have to deal with the practicalities of getting buildings up, and it's they who realise what eventually we come to see. But the interaction is, of course, fascinating. In this instance, the rebuilding of the Romanesque church in ways with means that we've been looking at in the Northern French context, Gothic ideas of height and wide windows and so on, led to the extension of the church beyond its 12th century limit, further east. That's what you're looking at to the left here. And as I think you can probably see, we're on one of the hills. The ground falls very steeply away here at the left-hand end of the slide. And so the eastern end of the church was being jettied out over a steeply falling hillside. And they hadn't got very far into the early... They started in the 1280s. They hadn't got very far in the very early 1300s when the new east end simply started to fall down the hill. So a great crack opened up, and it started to lurch down the hill. So the new cathedral was falling. It was being yanked apart by gravity. Now, you can imagine what some of the masons locally might have wanted to say about this, but the Signoria, and this does illustrate the continuing power of patronage, they called in masons from other cities to advise them, from half a dozen other cities, particularly Orvieto, where a cathedral had recently been completed, and they got these masons from Orvieto and others to have a look and give them and deliver their advice, and we have their advice, and these six masons say, guys, this is crazy, you are completely insane, you've got to stop, this is not safe, and only disaster will ensue. So the Signoria took this and read the advice, and then they said, right, okay, so we're going to build it much bigger still. So far from taking that advice, so as I say, masons have to be listened to up to a point, but where the idea of the patron reaches beyond, though you'll find on occasion, masons in turn then are given new tasks. And so what they decided to do was to curtail the plan to carry on building further east, out here into the void, as it were. You can still see the cracks here. And to reorientate the entire building so that what was the nave and the east end would become the mere transepts of a newly configured, vast, biggest in Christendom, cathedral with a nave on at right angles to this. So here on the right-hand side, you see the plan of the church as it is now in hard outline, the stumpy east end, frustratingly short, but reorientated according to the new plan, that would just have been the transept. And here, in the lower part of the slide, you see the partially completed nave of what, as I say, would have been a vaster and higher, wider and higher nave than any other in Christendom, including churches in Rome, at the day. And if you, those who've been to Seattle, you go to Seattle, you can actually now walk up onto the parts of this new projected cathedral that were completed. It's a dizzying height up at the top here, and you can see for many, many miles out into the countryside. It's a very, and this photograph on the left was taken from up there. So looking down, you see onto the existing cathedral. Amazing project. Maybe it's as well, in this context anyway, that the Black Death, that the plague arrived. So in 1348, the loss not just of population but funds meant that the whole project had to be given up. So I'm not saying patrons don't have any role, they certainly do. And it's in this tension and dialogue between patrons' ambitions and masons' responses that we can see many of the most interesting, in some cases influential, experiments of the period. So I emphasised at the beginning that we're not yet in the world of Renzo Piano or Richard Rogers and their, you know, their Armani suits and their social prestige, a separation from the general run of workmen. But nonetheless, we can detect hints in just a few cases that individuals who were the magistri operarum, the masters of the works, acquired a loftier respect than his manual labour would otherwise command. The master mason is going to be living on the site at any time, but he wears a long robe, which is different from the clothes of the other workmen, and he carries a staff, which means that he has the right to command not just the masons who might be the team within which he trained originally, but also everybody else who's got to collaborate with the masons, the carpenters, the glaziers, and so on. And we get hints of this respect for a limited number of masters of the works in images of designers in the floors of one or two of the cathedrals we've been talking about, Amiens and Reims. Well, we haven't been talking about them particularly, but again in northern France, and here in you can see the robes, and also perhaps you can just about make out the tools of the trade, the set square, the dividers that mark the man who's used to measuring out dimensions of arcades and the profiles of stone mouldings and so forth. The earliest, and the 13th century, also in the 13th century, and significantly from Reims, again, northeast of Paris, is the earliest tomb monument we have to a master mason. And he too, the inscription around the edge tells us his name, Hugues Libergier. He died in 1236, and he's shown holding a building, as it were, a model of Reims Cathedral. He's wearing that long robe, and there are other emblems of his profession, if you like. So there's certainly status here. These are always rare. Obviously we've lost things, but these are rare. But we do, you know, there are some later medieval ones as well. Here's a German example at Landshut from the early 15th century, where the designer of this church appears in his portrait, in a three-dimensional portrait, and with an inscription commemorating his role as the master builder. The fact that the earliest one is at Reims is surely no accident, because Reims really was a very high, highly visible, high prestige building, the coronation church of the Capetian kings. Responsible, therefore, for creating in that cathedral a kind of image of Christian monarchy. Now, just in the last few minutes, I wanted to just show how, once again, patrons' emulation of one another could drive new architectural developments. Because here, still in Paris in the 1240s, still in that Capetian zone of Paris, Reims, Saint-Denis, but in Paris itself in the 1230s and 40s, the then King of France, the then Capetian King, Louis IX, who had acquired the most amazing collection of relics in all of Christendom, including the crown of thorns from Christ's crucifixion, and arranged these on the high altar. He had built, by his masons and glaziers, this enormous, again, reliquary. So it's smaller than Canterbury Cathedral, but it's conceived in the same way as a kind of enlarged reliquary to house this extraordinary collection. And it was obviously intended as an extension of his own image as a Christian king, that he was looking after these, that Paris was under his aegis a kind of new Jerusalem. And you can see how, again, brilliantly, these new ideas of height and light are used in this instance. The Sainte-Chapelle was, as it still is, a sensation. And one of the people who were completely knocked sideways by it was the King of England, who in 1240, Henry III, went on a visit to Paris, and when he came back, he could not stop talking about Paris, and this actually became the butt of jokes. We've even got vernacular songs from the time ironising the king's obsession. He wanted to bring the Sainte-Chapelle back in a cart to London, this kind of thing. He told his courtiers they've got houses four stories high. We've really got to be more like Paris. And clearly, the prestige of the King of France had got in amongst him, and he was determined to have something that could begin to compete. And lo and behold, he hired Henry of Reims, the significantly named Master Mason, Master of the Works, for a new rebuilding of Westminster Abbey. And on the left, I'm showing you the north transept of Reims Cathedral, and on the right, I'm showing you, it's been slightly modified since, so I'm showing you the north transept of Westminster Abbey, where you can see that the recently completed Cathedral of Reims, as I say, the Coronation Church of the Capetians, becomes, through the English king's patronage of a master of works from Reims, the model, not a blueprint in every detail, but an inspiration for the new building of Westminster Abbey, with its rose window and its triple portico for the king to process into services and so on, next to the Royal Palace of Westminster, of course. What had very recently been worked out at Reims around 1230 by glaziers and masons, working now with increasingly risky thin members in stone to create quite delicate filigree effects in the windows, something which initially, back in Suger's day at Saint-Denis, you don't yet see, but here you're beginning to see new experiments, and then this is emulated and taken further at Westminster Abbey, here in the Chapter House that was finished in 1253. And in turn, the Chapter House of 1253, which is conceived as it's a polygon, a hexagon around a central, wonderfully thin, tree-like pier at the centre, this cluster of little piers, in fact, that spring out and support the roof, and then the enormously wide windows, as you see. And then this is emulated in the 1260s at Salisbury, where you can see various details cropping up, where the Bishop of Salisbury, member of the King's Court, is taking this idea on. Not everybody thought that what Henry was doing was the right thing. There was a politics about copying France, which barons and others in England contested. In fact, some of the secular barons gathered in Oxford precisely to complain that he was going too French, that this was too much in hoc to French culture, French influence. And not all bishops went the way of the Bishop of Salisbury in that instance. But anyway, what we see in these cases is a dynamic, always, I think, interesting interaction between ideas and inspirations of patrons, practical techniques, willingness to experiment, sometimes brilliant, pragmatic solutions on the part of craftspeople. And so finally, I'm sorry I've overrun slightly, but just finally, there are three points, it's always nice to have three points, that stand out from this short review of medieval building practice. First, the respect for architecture as a liberal art is a distinctively Western and recent phenomenon. Professionalisation, which sets the modern architect apart from mechanical builders and technicians, dates only from the 19th century. Second, the role of the patron in this as in other periods, and also in this as in other media, needs to be carefully weighed. On the one hand, not only the patron's money, but also the patron's personal, political, or religious agenda, presented as a dream or Christian kingship or whatever, but these ideas, clearly these affect significantly the choice of materials, the forms, the workmen employed. But we shouldn't confuse the ambitions of a patron for the ability to design a building. And the third and final point is the significance in architecture and in architectural history of the experimental, the pragmatic, the incomplete design. As I say, architectural history has always privileged the apparently complete building. But on this point, the medieval evidence isn't alone in suggesting that reality tended to be more unpredictable. As I say, the general point here, and this is my end, is that the subject matter of art history, although we might wish it otherwise, is always, in some sense, incomplete.